Welcome, everyone, to another installment of the ABR podcast series. Today, we have Nitin Gaur, who is the director of IBM's Financial Services and Digital Assets. Nitin has always been very passionate about shaping the technology landscape and to drive innovation and achieve business objectives on a global scale. He is a forward-thinking, business-minded executive with rich experience as a leader, strategist, an innovator entrenched in the design and development of enterprise infrastructures and applications, including leading-edge middleware and mobility solutions for Fortune 500 companies in 20 over countries. He's tenacious and customer-focused in analyzing opportunities, anticipating trends, and creating technologies that align with operational needs, catapult profitability, and dramatically improve the end customer experience. He is a skilled leader who is able to guide over 450 plus resources worldwide and lead cross-functional teams in complex matrix organizations. So let's get started. Let's dive right into the podcast. So first and foremost, we would like to thank you for taking the time to talk to Asia Blockchain Review. How are things with you and the company as we navigate this new normal?
Yeah, no, Anil, first of all, glad to be here, and thank you for the invitation to the Asia Blockchain Review. It certainly has been, at least for me, over 4 months, and the new normal, it's become sort of a routine now, which at least in blockchain world, we're not used to. Our industry, as you know, is fairly tumultuous in terms of the new innovations ranging, and I think one advantage we had for many of us who travel quite a bit and met many, many leaders, industry and technology leaders, exchanged perspectives and looked into new business opportunities. Some of that, of course, has moved online, but I still miss that personal touch that you would get in terms of having a face-to-face perspective exchange. And I'm pretty positive that it certainly had a business impact to the entire industry. So I'm hoping, you know, everyone's safe, but I also am hoping that this dies down and we can get back to the old normal.
Yes, for sure. I mean, I think all of us are definitely missing that human element in all of this. Just moving on to our second question, IBM Digital Asset Labs have been involved in the design concept, design to implementation, and eventually the production of blockchain technology. Even the notion of digital assets gets a treatment too. Maybe you would like to explain to our listeners in broad strokes about what you guys do, perhaps a bit of an overview of what you guys do as a whole, and also how things are kind of faring in 2020.
Of course. So I think, I founded Blockchain Labs in 2016, 2017, so early days of blockchain. And the biggest challenge back in the day was discerning blockchain from the notion of Bitcoin, because all the conversations were driven by Bitcoin conversations. So we founded, Blockchain Labs to basically bring the entire notion of the power of technology as a transaction system for a multi-party sort of, you know, building a trusted network for many of the existing sort of fragmented and fairly wide business networks. And then I think we spent about 3 years doing that, soup to nuts, from the fundamental design to the business modeling to the incentive economic structure, which inherently is available in permissionless networks like Ethereum and Bitcoin, is trying to borrow some of those tenets into the permission network, as we have termed it. And in that journey, which was fairly successful, I would say, for the enterprise blockchain space, I realized that after 3 years, most of the issues that we were tackling was around data dissemination. So we moved from an asynchronous data dissemination to a synchronous data dissemination problem. And if we were to adhere to the fundamental tenets of blockchain, you needed to have digital assets. So I founded Digital Asset Labs with the intent of giving a digital asset perspective to the application of blockchain technology and sort of applying that notion of digital asset to anything of value, and primarily leading from financial services to some of the elements in trade finance and many of the adjunct industry which intersects with financial services, either directly or indirectly. So in that space, again, the journey began in terms of not just the notion of how will a blockchain network evolve, what are the enterprise tenets of blockchain, how do we enforce some of the operative elements of blockchain networks from a consortium perspective, but also addressing the BLT perspective of it, which is the business, legal, and technical element. and understanding the definition of digital assets, the workflow associated with digital asset, and above all, integration of these digital assets as they move across the ecosystem into the respective enterprises and their back office systems. And that was, you know, that has been a fairly interesting challenge that, you know, while blockchain systems are coming up, there is a world that exists, and we have to make sure that the blockchain world and the traditional world coexist, and that integration becomes a really, really important part of the overall solution design. And lately now, at least in financial services, the notion of digital asset expands from purely technical play into sort of some of the regulatory and compliance ramifications of what the digital asset mean and how do you treat an asset depending on its definition, depending on its behavior, depending on its attributes. And so my team collectively brings the end-to-end perspective. Of course, I'm not the only one. We have adjunct entities like Promontory, which is our, you know, regulatory and compliance entity. So we work with them and some of our GBS folks to bring the business consulting elements, the technology elements, and the regulatory compliance elements together to provide a holistic point of view to our clients, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sounds like you have a very complex job at hand. Just leading on from what you were saying, as you have mentioned in previous interviews to other publications as well, blockchain technology, it's always evolving, and a lot of your time is spent talking to clients about understanding their requirements and trying to morph them into actionable solutions. So, it's definitely talking about right technology design and choices. So in a nutshell, how do you guys make these decisions meaningful and viable in the overall scheme of things?
Yeah, I think, Anil, that's a really brilliant question in terms of getting to the root of some of the challenges in the enterprise blockchain space. And I think the early days, and of course, we have failed in many projects, and I wear that as a badge of honor. Of course, with any new technologies, you fail and you learn from it. So many of the early design that we did, technically, of course, from a proof of concept to the minimum viable product or MVP, they always work. And the notion of that is that we achieve technical success, and then we figure out as to, fine, technically this thing works, how do we take this to the next level? And after many of such engagements, I came to a conclusion that we should probably reverse our thinking in sort of applying a more business-centric approach to these business networks, figuring out the consortium rules and regulations, the element of the participant sort of, rule book that every network needs, but also bringing some of the neutral industry players, but also the industry players together to form this sort of, consortium. But above all, application of technology in a meaningful way implies that, we are getting an economic benefit from it. And so again, I begin to discern between efficiency and efficacy, and efficiency is all about cost savings and making things cheaper, faster, better. But efficacy is more towards going after the right use investment and investment of resources to achieve a much more exponential result that you get from it. And so focusing with that principle in mind, we begin to sort of focus more early on the governance structure of blockchain networks and some of the business modeling that comes with it, and then focus on technical element. And as a technologist, I think I felt fairly comfortable with early day success that we could solve the technical problems depending on the requirements of the network and depending on some of the jurisdictional elements that go into and technology solving those problems. But I think the biggest challenge was navigating the business modeling elements and governance structure, because some of them are loaded with political ramifications, but also requires a management structure to seed it. And so that actually has been a fairly interesting journey. And so in many of my later day writings, I have begun to, expand on that learning and say, for most of the enterprise blockchain networks, including the non-enterprise-esque, which is the open networks, I think governance model becomes one of the primary fundamental criteria that needs to be addressed first.
Yeah, this definitely sounds extremely challenging in a lot of fronts. My next question is pretty broad. It's got quite a few different elements to it, so just bear with me. We're now living in a time where the whole world is experiencing trade imbalances, supply chain disruptions, geopolitical tensions, and just a lot of uncertainty all around. Blockchain is now becoming quite a key facet in supply chain management and finance. China, for instance, recently launched a blockchain service network, which will be based on open source technologies, but with probably some Chinese characteristics. It has the potential to go global with its own central bank digital currency as well. So, you know, I guess my question to you is that how do you think companies like IBM can stay ahead of the curve and design solutions that can not only take advantage of developments like this, but keep trailblazers at the forefront of this revolution we're seeing now?
Yeah, no, that's a loaded question, and so bear with me for the response as well. So I completely agree. I think in many cases, the disruptive elements that we see in the economy, some of them are geopolitical, some of them are sort of trade wars that are happening between various countries across the world that we have seen in the news. I think in many cases, and we have seen this firsthand, especially in some of our trusted supply chain solutions in IBM, where the biggest challenge of is establishing supply chain networks, besides the disruption because of COVID and because of some of the, again, environmental factors, is figuring out a truly global network and bypassing the initial hurdle of establishing trust and contractual obligations and going through the procurement cycles, which basically establish a relationship between two parties. So when we looked into the shortage of the face mask, the N95, and some of the protective personal equipment early days of COVID, we realized that there was all this locked capacity in various systems where the bigger challenge was not transportation, but the bigger challenge was how do I get over the hurdle of establishing that initial connection and establishing the contractual vehicles that I need to do. And in many cases, you know, procurement cycles require you to do certain due diligence and understand who you're dealing with before you establish the lines of payment and lines of communication. And so I think blockchain was early days very instrumental in solving that problem, because in many cases there were network verified suppliers and network verified purveyors and vendors of the PPE, and you could essentially go through a process and again deal with elements like payments and so on and so forth. And that at that point the issue then became only transportation and the logistics of actually moving this equipment. So I think blockchain solves to an extent a lot of these global issues of, again, the issue of time and trust, the time it takes to sort of break the silos and flatten that business processes of the notion of procurement, verification, validation, paperwork. But then it doesn't really solve the logistics element, right? That you still have oceans and you have ocean liners and you have carriers that need to have the right equipment. And then, you know, it can't bypass some of the embargoes and the government sort of bans that they may have on the actual trading element of it. So that's the balance that we begin to understand and realize that what can we do to make supply chain more resilient. And as you know, that historically when you make something efficient, what gives in that efficiency is resiliency, right? Because you're trying to make everything just in time to the point. So that is something which I think we have learned a lot and improvised in the past 6 months. And it's really amazing how our collective teams across IBM, because we do have our supply chain division, we have TradeLens, who are working on these areas, collectively we all came together to solve this issue in a fairly quick amount of time. And then within 6 weeks, we had the supply chain up and running. So that's the first part of the question. Second part of the question that you framed was around the BSN, which is the blockchain network. And what's interesting about some of the elements of the, if you draw similes between what is known as the Great Firewall of China, for instance, in terms of the monitoring of some of the traffic, it's counter to many of the things that we do with digital asset, of course, because you can stop or you can, you know, monitor information, stop information. But in some cases, when you start doing the blockchain networks, you're actually having a significant economic impact, because now you're impacting the free flow of things of value over these networks. So that's one data point which we would have to look into, that while there's a regulatory framework that deals with, you know, AML, KYC, and various elements to make sure that the funds and things of value not moving around the world for nefarious activities and terrorism funding, those still apply to existing banking system. But if we would apply the same rules with which historically many of the jurisdictions have looked at information, I think that lens would have to be shifted a little bit in terms of, again, for its own benefit. Otherwise, you're simply providing a technology platform and not exploiting it to its fullest. So openness, transparency are fundamental to blockchain. And when you try to circumvent that, then you lose some of the advantages of this, you know, what of this amazing technology. which I think is counter to many of the controlling elements and censorship elements that that governs blockchain. So censorship resistance is one of the main tenets of blockchain technology. And if you begin to change those models, then it becomes nothing but a middleware system of sorts. So for the way we look at IBM, and that's something which we've debated too, because as a technology company, our role is to innovate. Our role is to provide infrastructure. And so when you begin to discern between infrastructure and instrument, infrastructure is the actual technology that facilitates these rails, and instrument is the actual thing of value, I think one thing we could do as a company is focus on our core competency, which is focusing on providing enough technology, infrastructure, cloud abilities to do stuff, and then applying the various advanced stuff that we have, the AI and machine learning on top of blockchain networks to give you that notion of resilience and predictive analytics that's needed. And let the industry, whether it's a supply chain industry or trade finance industry or banking or financial institutions, deal with the governance and many of the other attributes of the instrument, which it could be a mortgage, could be mortgage-backed security, or could be payments. And that's one way we could keep a clear line of separation in terms of our role, because, we can't do everything. So hopefully that sort of answers some of the nuggets that you had in your question.
Yeah, that was amazing, actually. Okay. Just leading on from that, this leads back to your trade lens solution. So at a very basic level, trade does revolve around three layers, basically logistics, trade, and regulatory frameworks. So obviously, most companies would want to make all layers kind of synergize seamlessly in a way. But of course, the reality is that all of this is extremely messy. So perhaps you could give us a bit of a broad overview of these of how these elements kind of play with trade lens, and how do you guys actually simplify these all these complex sort of systems that are in place, right?
That's also a very question, and I'm glad you asked this, because it requires an intrinsic knowledge of some of the elements of technology, but also the elements of how business is conducted. So you're right. You're absolutely right of the fact that most of our economy runs on exchange of goods and exchange of value across borders, and movement of goods corresponds to movement of money. That's how the global trade works, which means you import, export, you move goods, and eventually, as a corresponding element of that movement of goods, movement of money happens through various different channels. And in between these two movements, you have various jurisdictions, various governments, because as the money goes through these different boundaries, it has to go through the various regulatory lenses of the various sort of checkpoints to get to the final destination. And that's true even for goods. Some goods need to be controlled, some are embargoed, and depending on which country and what rules you apply. So it's a fairly complex system that deals with trade logistics and trade finance, which is movement of goods and movement of money. And so that's one challenge, and it's challenging in its own right, that an average goods or import-export is usually between 17 to 36 different parties who are involved in actually transfer of a container of things. And things become more complex when you get into agriculture and get into more sort of rare earth metals and so on and so forth. So having said that, there are other challenges from blockchain perspective. As we're building these networks, you have smart contracts, you have digital assets that are meant to be homogenous only because of the fact that, you cannot apply the same rules of a smart contract to deal with money, which is payment instrument, and deal with container movement, because smart contracts are meant for something else, not to mention the fact that you need a consistent governance as these containers or as the money moves across the ecosystem. And you cannot really mix and put all different types of digital assets in one single network and call it a day. So what we begin to see now is you see a trade logistic network evolve. So TradeLens is a trade logistic network that basically services the trade logistic industry, which is the entire gamut of shippers and freight carriers and freight forwarders and so on and so forth. But then you also have, we are providing technology to products like WeTrade and Voltran and some of the Contour like entities which are purely on trade finance, which means they have specific networks with specificity around movement of money that involves trade, like bill of lading, letter of credit, and so on and so forth. And you also have now, you know, respective layers of governance in between, which basically are attached to either of the two networks. For example, the trade logistics network is attached to the taxation department and looking at phytosanitary certification, customs and port authorities, and so on and so forth. And similarly, you'll have the governance and regulatory layer included in the trade finance for things like travel rule and AML and KYC and so on and so forth. So you realize that each of these layers are embedded, and we begin to use the term network of networks eventually, which means that now each network is talking to other network that at every time a container moves, there's an event that gets triggered off that has a corresponding business function. So we see the world moving in that direction, that many of these very specialized networks will be homogenous for sake of better governance, for sake of better like-minded memberships, like all shipping companies, all freight forwarders, because they're in the same business. And same thing with financial services. And while they'll be very homogenous network, they'll have sort of interoperability requirement that will require them to keep an eye for elements of de-risking, so I can keep track of my containers and I can create business model on top of that, whether it's going after supply chain financing or fractional release of funds based on the risk and based on the movement of these containers. So it's certainly a long response, but I think that's something which we have begun to see.
Yeah, actually, you've already actually pretty much answered my next question, but I just wanted to just give a the next point will probably be about interoperability. So, in the world of trade, you know, from we talk about blockchain networks, even cryptocurrencies, all that. We're always trying to talk about more diverse, decentralized, and vibrant sort of ecosystem. But of course, you know, interoperability is always something that affects just it could be like technological differences or regulatory imbalances, or perhaps even different philosophical standpoints on the way things work. So when it comes to brass tacks, things that you've already addressed, such as digital assets, which we talk about letter of credits or bill of lading, etc. There's also a task to provide protocols that can work across networks that maintain the tangibility and integrity of these assets too. So I guess I just need a bit of a short summary. Like, how would you explain, we just explained it to our listeners, like on this technology solution versus industry led solutions. Like, how do you bridge that dichotomy?
No, that's, it's a really complicated, I'll try to shorten the summary of it. So there are two elements. One is the technical element. So protocols, Bitcoin has been there for 10 years now, but many of the protocols that have evolved, with the exception of Ethereum, are fairly nascent. But there has been almost about 5 years dedicated to the interoperability challenge. And there have been a series of things around using oracles and using sort of an asset locking mechanism or hash time locks, which basically simply means that to preserve the integrity of the asset as it moves across multiple networks, we have to figure things out, whether we bridge the networks where the asset moves, which has its own technical problems of figuring out the resolution of an asset and figuring out if it's really valid or if it's some sort of a random series of alphanumeric characters, versus asset locking, which basically says while the networks can be heterogeneous, I can have a mechanism that provides bridging between the two, where I can lock an asset in one network and create a corresponding asset, so the linkability of the asset is preserved as the asset moves across the whole network. So the technical level protocols. And there's been sizable amount of work done, and I think, like everything else in the world, I think we begin to see some element of pleasant sort of news in that space, where a lot of these issues are being solved, whether we're using Oracle Network or using an off-chain type solution. So that, to me, we will solve. As a technologist, I'm pretty confident we'll figure out a way where there's enough protocols right now in pipeline to solve that problem. It's just a matter of maturity and surrounding the governance around these protocols, but that's an important part, as we discussed earlier. The bigger challenge is the business. And the reason for that is because we already have an existing management information systems that are designed to keep track of the assets that are in the purview of a single enterprise, as opposed to having a network-level visibility of the assets. Not to mention the regulatory and compliance requirements of the asset visibility and visibility of the associated transactional details which oftentimes are quite challenging from both from competitive advantage perspective, but also from regulatory perspective. So I think solving that will be a longer tail element from a business systems perspective or management information systems perspective, as opposed to purely relying upon the blockchain-centric protocols that facilitates the movement of assets as you preserve the integrity of the assets across the network.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, there's definitely a lot to unpack there. You know, when we talk about, you know, the proliferation of DLT networks, you know, you've touched on, you know, the differences in technical requirements, privacy and confidentiality as well. So like, you know, when we talk about privacy-based currencies and enterprise DLT networks, there will probably be, you know, disagreements in governance sort of philosophies as well. This could affect things like, you know, Ethereum, Bitcoin Cash, or perhaps some regulations that are, you know, a bit incongruent. So of course, like when we talk about, I mean, this all comes back to interoperability. So if the interoperability kind of suffers, perhaps we could be going back to how things were, where you have, you know, growing silos of value and data, which will of course impede progress towards a decentralized sort of ecosystem. What are your thoughts on this? Am I on the wrong tack here?
No, you're absolutely right. I think the biggest irony of all ironies are crypto exchanges, right? The intent of crypto was to facilitate a purely decentralized peer-to-peer network. And today you have the most flourishing and most profitable entities are the crypto exchanges who facilitate that exchange mechanism between the two parties across the world. But inherently, blockchain, Ethereum, many of these networks are truly global networks. I mean, I've been dealing with Bitcoin now for 7+ years, and, you know, it's really, you know, seamless. It's, of course, it has challenges that I've, in my experiments, I've lost keys and I have no one to go to complain and retrieve those. I can see my asset in the network. I simply can't claim it because the key that requires to claim it is gone and the computation is too high for me to even claim it, you know. So some of these nuances do exist, but these are truly global networks. I can be anywhere in the world, still have access to my currencies, as opposed to dealing with the elements of banking and so on and so forth. But there's also an emerging element of DeFi, decentralized financing, that is trying to alleviate some of these challenges by creating, you know, decentralized exchanges or DEXs to essentially marry the issue of the interoperability challenge that we discussed before, which is the ability for me to move various assets from different networks and having the DEXs sort of provide that bridging capability, but also the element of the business challenge is saying, look, I shouldn't be having to pay X percentage because, you know, crypto was meant to be P2P network. So DEXs are trying to lower the cost of and the friction of what crypto exchanges provide, not to mention crypto exchanges, as you have historically seen, becomes a honeypot for many exploits, technical exploits as well as business exploits. And so DEXs become sort of the, and many of the decent definancing or decentralized financing projects become a good, you know, element to follow because they provide sort of an avenue to ease some of the challenges that you described. But of course, I don't think we have the biggest challenge to me is still a common man understanding this and getting into it, which is still quite a bit of, you know, ways to go for that.
Yeah. That's definitely true. I think it's, trying to educate the, trying to educate the masses about something like this, I think would be quite a long process. I just wanted to get a bit of a perspective on the Asian side of things. We did touch on the China's blockchain service network and its CBDC initiative as well. And of course, you know, there's a lot of tech initiatives that are, you know, a lot of technology initiatives that are coming from, countries on the greater China group, like Hong Kong, Taiwan. Of course, when we talk about, the heart of trade and financial markets, a lot of it, comes back to data, right? And of course, when we talk about trying to improve liquidity in these markets, of course, the new paradigm with blockchain and trade finance and all that, and this new, sort of perspective, I think, we still want to talk about how we can kind of improve liquidity in these markets. So, How do you think How do you think your work and IBM Digital Asset Labs kind of fits into this narrative?
Yeah, no, actually, I've worked on all these, the entire GCG countries, and a lot in Singapore. And so I'm very familiar with BRI or One Belt, One Road, and its ambitious plans of sort of amalgamating the maritime routes and silk routes of the ancient era. And again, building the parallel dominance that, you know, USD has today as a world reserve currency and so on and so forth. From perspective of digital asset, what we do, so we are, again, most digital asset conversation is rarely purely technical conversation anymore. So we begin to now, you know, have a digital asset practice, so to speak, where we have a workflow solution, which means what happens when you introduce a digital asset into a banking system and the adjunct system like treasury and custody and so on and so forth. We have a digital asset custody solution, which is built on very resilient, you know, federal approved hardware, which allows you to keep the asset secure, which the notion of custody for digital asset is ever growing. And last year alone, there has been a lot of funding that has gone into building these solutions from big names like Fidelity and Goldman Sachs and likes. And the other thing is, you know, like there have been new banking charters, not only in the U.S., but around the world in dealing with the special treatment of digital assets, especially to answer your last question around providing liquidity. So, for example, Wyoming and Washington in the U.S. have looked into having a special purpose depository institution or SPDs or SPDIs. In exactly to solve that problem is how do we induce liquidity in these networks, because liquidity becomes a really important part, especially when fiat is still sort of the main instrument that we use as a, you know, as a payment vehicle. So many jurisdictions, Switzerland, Singapore, they all have looked at this and saying, what is the reporting requirements? What is the LCR, the liquidity, you know, ratios required for the banks to maintain if they were to have the custody of digital asset, not only for the Basel reporting requirements, which is, you know, the healthy liquidity that banks need to maintain to reduce risk in the system, but also in terms of the technical requirement that we need to have to make sure that these are either, you know, air gap systems, or we are ensuring that we have, you know, have very high levels of protection from not just cyber theft and cyber security of, you know, of these systems, but also protecting it from internal threats. So combining the business elements, which is the workflow, combining the technology elements, which I just described, and combining the regulatory elements is what we believe that, you know, we bring that trifecta of sort of the holistic opinion on these things. And I think that is something which is unique, which we have built collectively, single entity. Because you'll have enough lawyers talking about the regulatory elements. You have enough tech companies that give you the custody solutions of some sort using some sort of HSMs or hardware security modules. And you have enough consulting powerhouses who can give you the workflow, but one-stop shop that gives you political, you know, that gives you an end-to-end, or rather political, but end-to-end perspective on the digital asset workflows, I think is unique. And that's where I think we are trying to establish ourselves.
That's a great response. So my final question, from a digital asset perspective, you've been quoted previously that tokenized fiats, stable coins, and related business models with financial institutions is, you know, it's been quite an interesting facet in your job scope. So, more importantly, you said that finding a way to use blockchain in meaningful ways for permissioned entities to come together and give birth to new business models is of course very important. You said that it's all about creating a seamless process that the world trusts. So perhaps you could leave our listeners with some final thoughts on this.
Yeah, I don't know. I think and I always tell people why I joined. What's my mission besides just working for a large corporation and trying to solve some of the very interesting problems of our times. A few things that we started out is for a few things that makes the world a better place. And I think as a technologist, many of us feel this way. And I, not just me, but, you know, the luminaries like, you know, Vitalik and many of the other guys who have gotten this space is looking into addressing elements of, you know, better world in terms of transparent financial systems, economic inclusion, and creating this, you know, a global marketplace of sorts. So the idea, the long-term vision of how I envision our work unfolding is that because we're creating global systems and we always compare that what internet has done for information, which kids of all ages today on the same map, They have access to the same information. They play the same games, which has sort of leveled the playing field when it comes to information, which back in the day was only limited to the West in most part because of the investment they had made in infrastructure, libraries, and books, and access to these information. Today, it's that landscape is sort of, you know, is leveled. Albeit the network may be a bit slow, but access to information is still there no matter which part of the world you go to today. So that's the positive side of what internet did. And we expect something similar to do what internet did for information, blockchain to do for things of value. So imagine a world where a farmer in Uganda would want to invest in an American financial system or in Singaporean financial system, European financial system, should be able to, you know, have a subset of his financial success, even if it's as low as $100 a year in some cases, which some farmers, you know, have to work very hard for a year, or some folks who are working in certain strata of society, is to be able to make that investment in the world economic system without actually having to have access to a very advanced high finance type infrastructure or go through a broker, because that $100 they can invest and eventually take advantage of the global economic system, all in a fashion where it's transparent, it's free of commission, or it's free of friction, but at the same time, it's a system that can be trusted. And that's the holy grail of where we're getting with this. So when we talk about tokenization and fractionalization of these things, the idea there is that ability for you to move money, so you can invest into an asset, whether it's 1/10 or 1/1,000,000 of a real estate in New York, or 1/100,000,000 of a shipping investment, all that is possible because we are tokenizing it. And you need the duality of every transaction, which means things like tokenized fiat or stable coins provide the other end of that equation to move money across. So I believe that in this world, we will succeed by the right application technology if we create a system that gives equal access to financial systems by anybody who has the will and the investment, you know, vehicle to participate. And that equal participation and inclusion in the financial system, I think, is something that I aspire to see.
Yeah, sure. That's great. Great. So Nitin, thanks a lot for, you know, taking the time today to talk to us. It's been a great privilege for ABR to have you on board.
Likewise, Anil, I'm really glad to have this conversation. It was interesting, and I wish you well and your audience. Hope you're safe, and let's all pray that this is behind us, this whole pandemic. With that, you have a great evening, and good talking to you.
All right then. See you, Nitin.